Gheeb Galeric's Faultier Oath, and welcome to the Gaelic Hour on this Christmas Eve here in Ottawa. What a wonderful, wonderful time of the year. We have a brilliant program put together for you today. I got a very, very positive response to the little piece I did 2 weeks ago where Mary read The Christmas Pudding. That's Mary Comerton, my fantastic wife, read The Christmas Pudding. So today, we are going to have some more readings from John D. Sheridan that are very seasonally appropriate. In addition to that, there are some little vignettes of stories relating to the time of the year from school children from inner city Dublin, in addition to some seasonal music. And this program is brought to you in part by the Irish Village, and we will be talking to Peter Uniat a little bit later on, because the Irish Village have their 14th annual Heart and Crown Christmas dinner tomorrow, and Peter's going to come on and tell us a little bit about it and what is planned and the number of meals that they do actually cater to. And if you've left your Christmas shopping a little bit late, get your pen ready. Here's a number you can phone, and maybe you're still time to pick up a CD. Frank Cassidy and James Stevens have just issued a CD, Thomas D'Arcy McGee. It's in honour of the life and times of Thomas D'Arcy McGee, with music by Frank Cassidy and James Stevens. So it's all original work, 25 new traditional style tunes. You can get that from Frank at 834-1857. And you have the opportunity also maybe to go out and buy some tickets for the Mahones. They're coming into town on January 14th. The Irish Society have that event organised, and it will be at the Capitol Music Hall on 200 Rideau Street. The doors open at 7 o'clock. Tickets are $20 in advance. They're available from Ticketmaster, so again, if you contact Ticketmaster, you might be able to get your gift organised before the end of the day. Two tickets for some lucky recipient for the Mahones. And I will have some giveaways, not this week, but early in January, for that concert.
During the weeks before Christmas, women may be divided into two groups: those who have already made My Christmas Cakes and are telling everyone about it, and those who have not yet made My Christmas Cakes and are telling everyone about it. The members of the first group spend most of their leisure time purring, and the rest of it in collecting solicited testimonials, for they have to be reassured from time to time that they have produced works of art. It would be as much as your life is worth to put the affair on any lower level. They hold the thing up for inspection and say, "What do you think of my cake?" which is about as sensible as holding up a manuscript and saying, "What do you think of my novel?" The members of the second group are given to cries of woe and lamentation. They stand at street corners and make heartbroken remarks about inexorable march of time. They seem to be looking for sympathy, but what they are really looking for is admiration. They are like college students who tell you a week before the examination, "I haven't opened a book yet," and mean that brilliant folk can always leave things to the very last minute. A woman's urge to make a Christmas cake has the intensity of a vocation. She sets about the making with the zeal and fervor of a priestess, and is unable to answer questions or mend her husband's socks until the crisis is over. Recipes for Christmas cakes are usually kept in special notebooks, and may be either handwritten or simply pasted in. Some women take their recipes from cookery books or from newspapers, and read out ingredients and amounts as they work, which is on a par with wearing brown shoes with a blue suit, or buying a ready-made plum pudding. The best people have their own special recipes, and the exercise books that house them are thickened at the edges with the flour of 20 years. Not that the recipe matters very much. It is the interpretation that counts. Two women may use the same recipe, but no two women ever make the same cake. Each makes a better one, and she will tell you as much when she gets you to herself. If you ever hear a woman admit that her neighbor has made a cake that is better than her own, you should make a sworn statement on the incident and have it signed by an attorney. Items of this kind are always useful in the early stages of canonization. The first step in the making of a Christmas cake is the assembling of the materials, preferably on a table on which someone else is ironing or on which the man of the house is doing his son's homework. Next, you clean the fruit with the help of your husband and children. This will ensure that your cake will not be too heavy, since the amount of fruit that goes into it will be only slightly greater than the amount that goes into the children's mouths. This done, you take half a pound or so, and the so is very important, of butter, and a half a pound or thereabouts of sugar, and start to beat the devil out of them in a delf bowl. As soon as you begin to feel a little faint, call in your husband before he escapes. Remind him of the price of butter, warn him not to break the bowl, and tell him to wallop away until the stuff has the consistency of cream. Presently, you grab the bowl from his numbed fingers, scrape the bulk of the mixture off his hands, tell him you would rather do the job yourself than be bothered looking at him, and start again to the old refrain that woman's work is never done. When he has recovered slightly and shows signs of sneaking away, lead him back to the bowl and make him finish the churning while you are lining the cake tin with four layers of greased paper. And so the merry work goes on. Relays of beaters bludgeon the butter and sugar into a mixture that has none of the characteristics of either butter or sugar. When it is in this condition, it is known as the batter, which is also what your husband goes on when he finally manages to escape. It is now time to add the eggs, which should be shelled first. When this has been done, you tilt in the fruit and produce a stuff that is like spotty cement, only dirtier. You must now try to mix the raisins well into the sticky mass that binds them together and break down any bridge heads of clotted fruit. If you're making fudge, your troubles are over now, but if you're making a Christmas cake, you should add some flour. Or you should have added it a while back. I'm not very clear on this point. All I know is that the time has come for transferring the spotty cement into the lined tin. It won't want to go, but you must make it go. You scrape it off the ladle with a knife, you scrape it off the knife with a ladle, and you lick your fingers when no one is looking. Next, the cake is put into the oven, and a great stillness comes over the house. For this is the crisis of the whole proceedings, and anything may happen. From time to time, you open the oven door with sick room gentleness and issue little bulletins like, "It's doing nicely. I hope I haven't too much fruit in it." Then you sit down to do a little knitting, though your fingers can scarcely hold the needles, and rise again screaming, "Good heavens, I've a cake in the oven." But presently, you have your reward. You bring in your cake, carrying it as proudly as a woman carries her first grandchild, and say, "Isn't it lovely?" Then you grin all over and wait for the applause, and those who know their place and have to live in the same house with you will give it without stint. Which is more than can be said for you and the Christmas cake, for all we will get of it will be a slice apiece, one miserly slice, cut with sacrificial care. The rest will be locked away reverently and produced while it lasts for the edification of the hypocritical visitors, who will roll their eyes when they taste it and then hurry home to say to their husbands, "I didn't think much of her cake."
You're listening to the Gaelic Hour on Chain 97.9. This is Austin Comerton. And what you were listening to there, that was a track from the Winter Crossing CD with James Galway and Phil Coulter, Christmas Eve in Ellis Island. Prior to that, Mary Comerton was reading Christmas Cakes from John D. Sheridan, a collection of short stories, My Hat Blew Off. As I mentioned at the top of the program, at the Irish Village, in the Heart and Crown, this is their fourth annual Christmas dinner. And I have on the line Peter Uniat. Peter, are you there? Peter? Hello? I guess we'll come back to Peter in a few moments. But we're going to have a quick chat with Peter on what they're doing and the arrangements that they're making down there. Hello, Peter? No, sorry. That's the one of the joys of live radio. The other thing we're going to do is we're going to play a little track of... this is quite interesting. Back prior before the Vatican Council, there was a very caring teacher in inner city Dublin who used a variety of methods to try and work with the children to teach them Bible stories. And one of the things she did was she encouraged them to go off and learn the story and come back into school and tell the story into a tape recorder on the basis that they may end up being broadcast on the radio. Now, actually, at the time, the kids didn't realize, or she didn't realize, these would end up being broadcast on the radio, and they were. So what we're about to hear is the children's rendition of the Annunciation and the Visitation, told in a nice inner-city Dublin accent. And when we come back after that, we should have Peter Uniat on the line.
This day God called one of his most important angels over, and his name was Angel Gabriel. And he said, "Come here, Angel Gabriel. I want you to go down to the world to a girl named Mary and speak nice to her, because I want her to be my mother." And he went down and he disappeared in the room and he said, "Hail full of grace, the Lord is with thee." And she got a bit afraid and he said, "Don't be afraid, Mary, I've great news from God. God sent me down to see would you be his mother." And she said, "Behold, the handmaid of the Lord, be it done unto me according to thy word." And that meant that she'd do anything God asked her to do. And he went, when he was gone now, and he was at the step, and he thought of another brilliant message, and he said, he went back in, and he said, "I have more news for you, Mary. Your cousin St. Elizabeth is getting a new baby boy from God." And the lady was delighted because she, St. Elizabeth hadn't got a boy or a girl or a young one or anything.
This day, after the angel went out the door, our Blessed Lady made up her mind to go to visit her cousin St. Elizabeth. And so she said she'd go. And so she brought food to her that would do her for the 3 days walking. And because she knew there was no bikes or nothing. So she got outside and spotted on Oliver Plunkett's head, spotted on the whole excursion. And so she had to walk on all the bony stones and cut the feet off you. And so there was no bicycles, cars, or nothing to give her a lift. And so when she got there, she was jaded, and St. Elizabeth was looking out the window, and she seen her. And just as she was going out, the Holy Ghost whispered into her ear, "She's going to be the mother of God, speak nice to her." And she went out, she threw her arms around her. And so, she said, "Blessed art thou among women. I'm not good enough for the Mother of God to come into my house." And our Blessed Lady made a gorgeous prayer. And we don't know yet to a big, because Miss Cunningham knows it. And when we're big, she's going to tell it to us. And so then she brought her in and she gave her the grub that they had for tea. And so they had a bit of a chat about the angel disappearing. And so she got up and she cleaned all her pictures and all. Not that St. Elizabeth's house was dirty or anything. And so she said to St. Elizabeth, "I'm going to stay here till the baby gets born." And so she did, and it got born. It was a young filly. And they were going to call her after his daddy, and his daddy's name was Zachary. And so the dad said, "No, he must be called John."
Out of the mouths of babes. Isn't it fantastic when you hear the simplicity that comes out of on a story like that? By the way, you can reach me by email, and I am connected live while on air, and it's gaelic@fidelity.ca. That's G-A-E-L-I-C at F-Y-D-E-L-I-T-Y.ca. And this is also available on the web as a stream, and it's archived for a week. Peter Uniat from the Heart and Crown. Do I have you there?
How are you doing, Austin?
Finally, Peter, it's good to talk to you. I know you're busy down there. You're getting all organized for the Christmas dinner tomorrow, and this is the 14th year.
Yeah, that's correct. This is our 14th annual, Austin, and we have lots of volunteers around from the community and business. They're all in here right now prepping some turkeys and getting ready to come down tomorrow and put on the whole event.
So how many people last year did you feed?
It was about 600 people. We had 600 plates go out. They had some people phone ahead. They weren't able to get out, and so they had their friends come in and pick up for them. But about 600 people, and we gave out about 250 gifts.
Wonderful. So what time do you start, and what time does you kind of the last serving?
Runs from about 10 a.m. till 4 p.m., and there's usually a bunch of people waiting to get in at 10, and we're in a hurry to get her going because everybody's a little late being Christmas. But starts at 10 sharp and runs till 4.
So the 600 people that went through the doors last year, you get a broad group of people that come in, and I'm sure at this stage you've seen some people come in that have been in previous years.
Yeah, there's definitely some familiar faces. Some of them are just people that don't have anywhere to go and they want to come and hang out. Usually they volunteer. They come and have a meal and hang out. There's a couple of people that come and play guitar, some families, all sorts of people come in.
So in reality, there's a creation of a tremendous sense of community.
Yeah, it was a really good feeling in the pub that day.
Wonderful. And for someone that really doesn't have, that is lonely or doesn't have anywhere that they can relate to someone, it creates a nice, warm, welcoming environment for them.
Well, that's it. And even the people that some of the more unfortunate people around us that have to get some meals out of the local shepherds of the mission that do some great jobs around here, at least they can, you know, for a change, they can come into a restaurant, you know, and they can be served by somebody and have a nice little seating, you know.
I noticed that one of the things you had asked for were donations for warm winter clothing for adults and children and some toys for children and also desserts. I'm sure you still have a requirement, or more donations are always welcome.
Yeah, we're still looking for more gloves and toques and coats and boots and whatever people have around the house, you know. Sometimes you're given things or you buy them and you never use them even. They're perfect for sending on in.
So
generosity is appreciated.
So if anyone's coming downtown and they know their neighbors or anything are coming down, just walk into the Irish Village and hand it in at any of the counters there and someone will gladly accept it.
Oh, definitely. Just drop it right into the Irish Village at 67 Clarence, and we'll gladly accept it, and we appreciate your donation. I'm sure that the people that get them do.
And I noticed you were also... how are you for turkeys and desserts?
Desserts are a little shy right now, but I expect we have a lot of regulars that bring in a lot of desserts every year, and they all seem to be coming through today.
Okay.
And turkeys, we got a tremendous response from Loeb on Rideau.
Good.
And our suppliers, as well as a lot of the regulars, keep bringing in turkeys. Sassy Bead, the staff there, brought in 3 turkeys themselves.
Good stuff. Good. Well, Peter, I don't want to keep you on here too long because I know you have to get back in there and keep the troops motivated and get working so as everything is ready for at 10 a.m. in the morning. And I hopefully will drop down a short while after now and drop in and say hello to you as well.
Okay, great. Thank you, Austin, and have a Merry Christmas, everyone.
Thanks a million. Take care, Peter. Sure.
Christmas parties, and paper hats. Almost every periodical that runs to a Christmas number, and the only ones that don't are the telephone directory and the summer bus guide, gets a member of the staff to dig up and modernize, or has foisted on it by an outside contributor, that traditional standby of the double number, hints for your Christmas party. And for the life of me, I can't see why. For except in prisons, big hotels, and the sergeant's mess, there's no such thing as a Christmas party. The Christmas party was invented by Dickens and eagerly adopted by modern writers of crime stories who have to have some excuse for getting a herd of suspects together under one roof. I resent the suggestion that one cannot face Christmas properly without a collection of puzzles, games, and mathematical posers. I regard it as an affront to the tradition of near gluttony and indolence that marks Christmas in respectable middle-class homes that can't afford it. But the most degrading feature of these unnecessary hints for non-existent parties is the batch of illustrations that goes with it. The main idea in the artist's mind is that a person in a paper hat is necessarily enjoying himself, which is a gross exaggeration. A young man in a paper hat that leaves his curls showing may be enjoying himself, and a young girl in a paper hat that suits her, which is the only kind of paper hat that a young girl will wear, is almost certainly enjoying herself. But a middle-aged man in a paper hat that makes him look repulsive, which is the only kind of paper hat made, is already comatose. If he weren't, he wouldn't permit this indignity to his face. At the paper hat stage of the Christmas dinner, I can pull a cracker as well or as badly as any man of my age. I pull with the ponderous insensibility of an elephant dragging a log out of a swamp. I pull without hilarity, almost without emotion, and I know what is coming. The other party to the contract may get a hat that will show off his curls or be kind to the tilt of her nose, but I'm doomed from the start. I get a hat that splits on my skull and makes me look like Crippen, Jack the Ripper, are the last days of Henry VIII. But I don't care. At that stage of the Christmas dinner, I'm past caring. I am full. I am as relaxed as an ox after a long day in deep pasture. If you took a photograph of me and my paper hat, you could give it any title you like, from Freak Potato to Curious Cloud Formation on Mount Everest. A middle-aged man in a Christmas paper hat is fit only to move from the table, evict his eldest son from the armchair, and reflect on the annual problem of how to doze off without either letting his cigar go out or setting fire to his paper hat. He grunts when he's offered fruit, grunts when he's asked to put coal on the fire, grunts when someone suggests a cup of tea, and grunts when the children run across his toes. But, and make no mistake about it, he's not bored. His spirit is not broken. He is still head of the house. He is a very Christian gentleman, taking his rest and enjoying himself in the great old European tradition. He may seem half asleep, he may seem wholly asleep, but he is still in control of his faculties. And you can prove it by asking him to join in any of the imbecilities of the magazine-type Christmas party, to take 2 matches from 12 and leave 13, or get a penny from under a tumbler without touching the tumbler, or choose any card from the pack. He may be wearing a paper hat, he may be looking like a fried egg, but he is not to be trifled with. Admittedly, he won't answer you in words, for he is beyond words, but he will answer you. He will rise from his chair in slow installments, look at you like a wounded lion from beneath the eaves of his torn paper hat, and go majestically upstairs to bed.
My name is Francis Tolliver, I come from Liverpool. 2 years ago, the war was waiting for me after school. To Belgium and to Flanders, to Germany to here, I fought for king and country I love dear. 'Twas Christmas in the trenches, where the frost so bitter hung, and the frozen fields of France were still, no songs of peace were sung. Our families back in England were toasting us that day, their brave and glorious sons so far away. I was lying with my messmates on a cold and rocky ground, when across the lines of battle came a most peculiar sound. Now listen up, me lads, says I, each soldier strained to hear, as one young German voice sang out so clear. He's singing bloody well, you know, my comrades said to me. Soon one by one, each German voice was joined in harmony. The cannon, they were silent, the gas cloud rolled no more, as Christmas brought us rest from the war. Well, as soon as they were finished, and a reverend cause was spent, God rest ye merry gentlemen, sang up some lads from Kent. The next they sang was still enough, to silent night, says I, and into tongue one song filled up the sky. There's someone coming towards us, our frontline sentry cried. All sights were fixed on one lone figure coming from their side. His truce flag, like a Christmas star, shone on that plain so bright, as he bravely trudged on arms into the night. Soon one by one from either side walked into no man's land, but neither gun nor bayonet, we joined there hand to hand. We shared some secret brandy, and we wished each other well, and in a flare-lit soccer match we gave them hell. We traded chocolates, cigarettes, and photographs from home. These sons and fathers far away from families of their own. Young Saunders played his squeeze box, they had a viol. This curious and unlikely band of men. France once more, With sad farewells, we each began to settle back to war. But the question haunted every heart that lived that wondrous night. Whose family have I fixed within my sights? 'Twas Christmas in the kitchen, where the frost so bitter hung. But the frozen fields of France were warm as songs of peace were sung. The walls they built between us to accept the work of war were tumbled and were gone forevermore. My name is Francis Tolliver, in Liverpool I dwell. Each Christmas time since World War I, I've learned the lesson well. The ones who give the orders aren't among the dead and lame. And each end of the rifle, we're the same.
And that was Evans and Doherty with Christmas in the Trenches. I played John McDermott's version of that last week, and I play it particularly because it's so poignant at this time of the year, the whole meaning of Christmas being where people who are in combat and on opposite sides of the fence can come together and lay down their arms, and we're able to enjoy each other's fellowship. Prior to that, Mary, you heard Mary reading from John D. Sheridan's My Hat Blew Off, Christmas Parties and Paper Hats. And as I mentioned last week, John D. Was married to my father's sister, was an uncle, and Mary and I knew John D. and many of his family before we came to Canada. I want to take this moment to congratulate my first cousin, Timothy O'Connor, on his engagement, which he popped the question yesterday, and Sue McGraw. Congratulations to you both, and when you announce the wonderful day, we'll broadcast that for you as well to make sure everybody knows when, where they can come and cheer you on. We're going to have another little piece from the inner city school in Dublin, and on this piece, the sound quality is a little bit poorer than on the last one, and as I said, you know, this was recorded on just a regular old tape recorder back before Vatican II. And the conditions in inner city Dublin where the school was not the best, there's noise in the background, there's trucks going by, there's children coughing because their health wasn't the best. As you know, we're dealing in an area where people were not that well off. But yet they had a simplicity which allowed them to grasp quite complex things in a lot of ways. And this is the story of the birth of Jesus.
This night, a lady on St. Joseph was going up to get registered, and when they were walking down the road, they were knocking at the doors and said he had no room. And the good people, if they had known that was a lady on St. Joseph, they would have got up and let them in. And the bad people looked out and said, sure, they're only poor, and they'd only pay a few coppers. And the mean kids that don't get Holy Communion on confession on Christmas morning, they're just the same as the second fellas, the bad fellas that said to a lady, we've no room for you. And the mean kids say we're too busy eating their sausages or playing with their toys or whatever they had for their breakfast. And they were going down the road and he met this man, and he said, have you any room? And he said, no, but there's an old stable over there that I owned if you want to go into it. And he went over, and a light came down from heaven at 12 o'clock, and loads of beautiful angels was with him. And it was these shepherds, and shepherds are fellows that mind the bulls and cows and sheep and little lambs and all. And he heard this beautiful music up in the sky, and he wondered what was up, and an angel disappeared to him, and he said, I was wondering what's up, and he said, yeah, and he said, the Saviour is born. If you want to go to see him, follow that star up in the sky. And it was a beautiful star.
Clancy Brothers with Angels We Have Heard on High, and that's from a compilation, All Time Christmas. And Mary's going to read another one of John Dee's stories, and this one is a letter to Santa, and it's quite humorous, as are all of his. And the other thing then, I do want to make one or two other announcements. Don't forget, every Tuesday night over at the Gap at Dunloe, there is a session, and on Monday nights from 8 o'clock on, there's one up at Rasputin's on Bronson. And on the 14th of January, that concert with the Mahones will be on. You can get a link on the website to get tickets from Ticketmaster under the auspices of the Irish Society. Mary, you're over to you.
Dear Santa, as one hypocrite to another, greetings and good wishes. The thing is done. I've stored away against the vigil of the feast a great rustling of brown paper parcels. So you may set your mind at ease about my loyalty. I'm still prepared, provided that the cost of living does not balloon out of my reach, to act as your local representative and depot superintendent until such time as my illustrious virtues discover my duplicity. And even now I must tell you they have their doubts. This year, as every year, there has been a mild outbreak of that old heresy that occurs with the regularity of measles, but I've scotched it with the traditional specific, and the threat of empty stockings has worked again. Our house is sound, and though there have been a few defections in the neighbourhood, they are not worth worrying about. New clients are plentiful in prams and cradles, and they will more than make up for a wastage that must be regarded as inevitable. We have maintained our position, and I think that the director should have no hesitation in declaring the usual dividend. But there is a much more serious heresy in the air, and it has so many voices and so many shapes, like the Dark Prince, who is its perennial source, that we who gave up believing in you years ago, but can never give up believing in what you stand for, are sometimes half afraid to read the headlines. Once, and not so long ago, Europe, at this blessed time of year, was a blaze of lighted church windows, carols meant more than carousels, and red symbolic candles shone out from a million stills to guide your landings. But the lights grow fewer every year, and a great darkness is spreading over the face of Christendom. You were always a legend, Santa, but now they are trying to make you a lie. And you were never a lie. You were, rather, a logical necessity. You just had to be invented. You stand not just for a parable, but for a whole medley of parables. You represent, for instance, the belief that prayers are heard and answered, the belief that time and space do not exist in the spiritual dimension, the belief that there is a bounty that is not embarrassed or diminished by the number of its clients or the immensity of their needs. You are only a fairy story, and that is why you have lasted so long. Had you ever been as real as Charlemagne, you would now be as dim and shadowy as Hannibal. You have lived because you have in you the deathless stuff of the best fairy stories, for the best fairy stories are all variants of the story that Adam heard at the gate of Eden, and that was no fairy story. The meaning and message of fairy stories is that all things come right in the end, that Michael's sword is still drawn, and that everyone who keeps the rules and does his best has a guarantee that he will live happily ever after. And the stock plot of the fairy story is that the king's son often comes in disguise, which is the very way the king's son did come. I don't mind children not believing in you, for children must grow up, and when a child is ready for the truth, he is the better of hearing it. But he must be prepared for it. It must not be jumped on him too suddenly. It is not easy to explain to a child that Bethlehem is not just a place or a time, but a continuing gift that reaches out to all times and all places. The truth must be softened and made easy, and that is where you come in. That is why the traditional way of rearing a Christian is to start him on Santa Claus. One of the things that puzzle many moderns, Santa, is that you did not die a natural death when Columbus discovered America or when Harvey discovered the circulation of the blood. They talk about the persistence of the legend and put it down to sentiment. They even talk of abolishing you and say that children should be told the truth. But have no fear. Abolishing you, you hoary old pretender, would mean abolishing the theology that is at the back of you and would leave us with nothing but lies to tell our children. It would be quite easy to ban you from hoardings and shop fronts, to bar you from cards and calendars, but you are not just 10 million pictures, nor yet 10,000 men hired to wear red gowns and white beards during the Christmas rush. You are part of the tradition that is Bethlehem and Calvary. You are the cry of the prophets of old. You are a footnote to the fairy tale that came true. You are protected by the most comforting of all promises. No darkness can ever blot you out or prevail finally against the things that you stand for. And nothing is surer than that the spatter of Christmas lights that once pinpointed Europe from Tagus to Volga will come again in God's good time. That is why I am still prepared, in spite of the cost of living, to act as your local representative and depot superintendent until my illustrious virtues find both of us out. Why I am prepared to perpetuate a legend that looks like a lie but is merely a cloak for the truth. Why I can say, literally and with all reverence, that the tiny things I have wrapped in brown paper and hidden away against the vigil of the feast are part of the deposit of faith. But sure, who am I telling it to?
And you have been listening to the Gaelic Hour on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Cummerton, Mary Cummerton, and also in studio with me is my mother. Morning, Cummerton. Morning. Do you want to say Happy Christmas to the folks out there? Come over to them, or just come up to the microphone and speak right in.
Happy Christmas to everybody. Happy Christmas to everybody, and especially to my family, who have been putting up with me all these years and spoiling me rotten. It is my privilege to be here with them and to be still able to travel twice a year from Ireland, summer and Christmas. God bless.
Merry Christmas from all the Cummertons at Blackburn Hamlet, and I'm absolutely thrilled today to be with here in the studio with my mother-in-law, Maureen Cummerton, who is just a terrific person, and it's wonderful to have her here at Christmas with us.
And we will be back tomorrow, and we will be playing The Chieftains, The Bells of Dublin. So the whole CD, I'm going to run through it because it's so appropriate. And the music, everything to do with that CD is just, I put it together, rearranged the music in a different order. So you tune in tomorrow, enjoy The Chieftains, The Bells of Dublin. And from Austin Cummerton, Mary Cummerton, Maureen Cummerton, have a wonderful, happy Christmas. Peaceful. And we'll be here with you tomorrow. Come back and listen. And this program was brought to you in part by the Irish Village.
A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight, walking in a winter wonderland. Gone away is the bluebird, here to stay is a new bird. He sings a love song as we go along. In the meadow we can build a snowman. Then the chimney is sparse and brown. He'll say, are you married? He'll say, no man. But you can do the job when you're in town. Later on we'll conspire as we dream by the fire.